This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
The reality is the most effective channel for any new business is PR.
You really got to understand your audience well enough to then tailor your approach.
Really talking about your wins is a critical component to an early stage business.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 53. And if you are here for the first time, thank you very much for joining us. If you are coming back from listening to previous episodes, then welcome back. Who have we got this week? Well, we've got a gentleman by the name of Rob Hangozada. It is a double-barreled surname, Hango-Zada. If you want to look him up on LinkedIn or Google him or whatever, he is the CEO and, well, the joint CEO of a company called Shipit. Be very careful how you say that if you've had a few drinks. They are a shipping company that is dedicated to helping e-commerce companies make their shipping smoother and easier and hopefully cheaper as well. So they've been around for almost 5 years. It is a great product. I heard about it actually in a podcast. I think actually in the interview, I forget the name of the podcast, but I've remembered since then because this bit is recorded after the interview. It was the Investors Podcast, which is a very big, well-listened to podcast. He has a lot of insight into starting a business, reaching out to new customers, building a profile, using PR companies, which was quite an interesting conversation as well. And also, obviously, into e-commerce as well, because that is where he really spends his time. So Rob is a very, very interesting fellow based down in Sydney again. Well worth listening to, and hopefully you'll get a lot from that interview. Now, the usual bits and pieces, please rate and review us on iTunes. We would very much appreciate that. Even if you can't be bothered to write a review, and I know that it's very hard to get round to writing a review sometimes, but even if you just punch the little 5-star button, that would help us enormously. So that would be great. The other things, come and find us on Instagram, simondell.com, DOTCOM. You can find us there. If you're looking to do your own podcast, wherever in the world you are, talk to Gilberto, thepodcastboss.com. He can help you out. And finally, come and talk to us. If you are a business that is looking for help with digital marketing or digital transformation, be it anything from an SEO all the way up to Google AdWords campaigns to actually not all the way up to Google AdWords campaigns, but all the way up to CRM integrations, marketing automation, all those kind of bits and pieces. We've done some big projects. We're working on some big projects in that field at the moment. So if you are looking to transform your business digitally, we are the people to talk to. So come and find us, www.simondell.com or hello@simondell.com. That is pretty much it for my intro. So let us jump into the interview with Rob. Welcome to the show, Rob Hangozada. It's very nice to have you. How are you?
I'm well, Simon. Thank you for having me on the show.
And whereabouts are you in the world today? I didn't actually look at that. I should have done that.
Well, we're based down in Sydney, so okay. that's where I'm today, in sunny, humid, muggy Sydney.
Cool, fantastic. Now, you do have the best surname that I have had on the show so far, and as I said to you before we started, it does sound like a cool Star Wars character, and I'm sure you've heard that about 1,000 times. But where's the background from the name? Was that because I actually used to be double barreled myself? It's a very long story which I shan't go into now. But was it a double barrel when you got married, or was it someone sort of previous to that?
You know, I wish there was some type of, you know, new age reason behind the surname, but frankly speaking, it's kind of a hangover from I guess the Middle East and the Ottoman Empire and all that sort of stuff. The origins of the surname are kind of traced back to Armenia, but prior to that, God knows. So I'm told that Zada is actually a symbolism for greatness or a suffix for greatness, and it was appended to the last name back in sort of the 1800s at some point. So that's kind of all I know about it. Yeah, I was born and raised in Australia, and there aren't too many Hango Zadas around, so it helps with my SEO. So that's good.
My father is threatening to do one of those DNA tests where you track your ancestry, and I'm kind of fearful for that because I think he's got a few
worried about what's hiding in the closet.
Yeah, I think there is a few back there. I think we've got a branch of our family from around the same sort of area as that sort of Armenian kind of. Space, but anyway,
there you go.
We could talk about this, but this isn't why we're here today. You are the joint CEO of a organization called Ship It. Do you want to give us the I normally say to people, give us the elevator pitch, but we've got longer than an elevator pitch, so tell us a little bit about Ship It.
No problem. So Ship It really is about simplifying the post-purchase processes for businesses. So everything to do with shipping, fulfillment, and even the returns process for a retail business. So specifically what we do is really enable our retail customers to save money on shipping by giving them the best services available in the market and reducing the time it takes them to do that. So saving them time in deciding which carriers to use and how to actually ship their products out. And then finally, once the shipment has been booked, the entire end-to-end tracking experience for their end customer. So it can really improve the customer experience customers getting for the retailer, and also reduce the inbound inquiries that retailer usually gets around where the F is my parcel. Finally, the returns piece is really removing all the friction that exists in the returns process today for retail merchants. But our mission here is to really simplify the way people send things to anyone, anywhere in the world.
So who would you be working with? Throw some names out there of people we might know, or unless it's secret, but I'm assuming it's not secret.
No secrets here, warts and all, Simon. So we work with some pretty impressive retail brands and some pretty impressive founders at the kind of lower end of the spectrum. So some of our more prominent names that we work with are Sephora, General Pants, you know, Temple and Webster, Harvey Norman. These are some of our really important flagship clients. And then we work with smaller businesses who you may never heard of, or businesses that you see pop up in the Instagram feed every now and then as well. So brands like Thank You, brands like the Horse Watch Company, Key Eyewear, and a number of others, all the way down to Simon's t-shirts that you sell on eBay, mate. So that's right. Kind of our customer base.
Cool. Be going for about, it's coming up to...
Well, 5 years from the beer that Will and I had where we discussed the idea, but, you know, kind of the fourth year in market. So we actually launched the business in February 2015.
So tell me about that beer. Where were you? What was the beer? And where was that light bulb moment for you guys? And what sort of triggered it? Where, you know, that kind of, you know, pattern of events that triggered that kind of conversation?
Yeah, well, basically what got us into this mess, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Will and I, for better or for worse, have known each other around 15 years. So we're good mates back in uni, and we obviously frequently catch up. So being close as we are, you know, we'd often grab a beer. So I think we were out at a bar somewhere in Surrey Hills. The beer was probably an Asahi or something to that effect.
Okay.
And, you know, we got to talking, and we're always talking about some random crap. So we got to talking about delivery experiences. And at the time, my wife was ordering a hell of a lot online, and I was the sucker who was going down to the post office to pick up all the unknown items that we'd get these delivery slips for in the mail. I was talking about how bloody annoying that process was. And then Will kind of turned around and said, funny enough, I've got the same story. So, you know, I got a vacuum cleaner online. So I bought a Dyson from you know, then Masters, which is the Bunnings competitor.
Yeah.
you know, and it was being delivered by a company, and they called him whilst he was at work in the CBD, and they said, look, we've got a vacuum cleaner to drop off for you. Are you home to sign for it? And he said, obviously, I'm not. I'm at work. And then it went through that whole rigmarole of not being able to leave the parcel because there was no authority, back and forth with the retailer, back and forth with the courier. Long story short, Will had to drive his car into the city, pay for parking in the city, get a big vacuum cleaner delivered to his mailroom, to which the mailroom administrator was not very happy with him. And we both looked at each other and said, how on earth is e-commerce supposed to grow if the delivery experience is this inconvenient? So you've got a really convenient way of purchasing, but it's almost like the morning after the big event, right? It's like, shit, I regret doing that. I'm never doing that again. And that's kind of what scratched the itch. And we basically went deeper into understanding what drove that.
Right. So, and here you are 5 odd years later with this business.
Yeah.
What were some of the early stage challenges of it? Because obviously, you know, I'm kind of guessing, and we'll talk about your background in you know, big brands and retail later on, but I guess you probably didn't have that much, other than being a consumer, you didn't really have that much experience of the whole shipping industry.
Mate, nothing at all. So no logistics experience, which is a double-edged sword that I'll kind of talk to in a minute, and no real experience in online retailing or software for that matter. So it was a complete white space territory for me, other than the fact that I was an avid consumer of kind of online retailing. And Will was a very similar story. So he had a bit of experience in tech, working in the fintech space through consulting, but none of us really knew what we were getting into, which was probably a bit liberating for us.
Well, tell me about the logistics. So the challenge is, you know, delving into that.
Yeah. So obviously at the time I was running a pretty big team for Unilever, in the shopper. At the time, actually, I was in marketing for Cup of Soup and the dry soups category for Unilever. Will, on the other hand, was running a fairly big team for PwC, frequently traveling overseas to the UK. I was frequently traveling to Singapore, down to Melbourne and all around. So the biggest challenge for us in the early stages was just getting the headspace, right? Yeah. So, the time to actually start looking into this, and it became a little addictive in the early days, because we started, you know, sort of curiously digging and kind of looking into data and looking into what other businesses are doing in the space, you know, buying more online to see how the experience is different across different retailers, really trying to see what the problems were. So, you know, the biggest challenge in the early days was pretty much time management. And committing to doing stuff. So I'm sure a lot of your listeners and you know, even yourself in the past, Simon, have had ideas, but you've never really acted on them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's just been, oh, well, that would be a good idea, but if I only had the time, you know. And I think in the early days, what really helped us was Will and I would kind of speak to each other almost on a daily basis, and we kind of said to each other, well, all right, we've got to commit to something here. You know, what are the 5 things you're going to do this week, and what are the 5 things I'm going to do this week? And we'd send each other an email every Monday morning, and we call it the week commencing email.
Right.
And it was, these are the 5 things I'm going to do. So one could be, I'm going to look into industry, you know, trends and stats, or I'm going to review this competitor, or I'm going to look at this market opportunity. And we'd come back, circle back, and kind of then figure out, okay, what does that then mean for us? So that was the initial challenge. Learning was really, really interesting, right? So we could jump into a new territory. We were coming from consulting. I was kind of doing a consulting role at FMCG businesses, and kind of being able to learn about a new territory or a new domain was really interesting for us. And so that's what kind of drove the passion in the early days.
Yeah.
But then as it started to get a bit more real, time got even more challenging.
What did you do the early stages? So, you know, presumably you've got a product, you've got something that you can take to market. How did you, what were the sort of first steps to actually get people using it out there?
Well, mate, even the process from that initial beer to having a product took us a whole year, right? So working our full-time jobs, you know, moonlighting as these co-founders of a really successful business that didn't have a business, you know, because when you show up to a customer, it's a bit like a uni graduate trying to get a job. Everyone wants a graduate, but everyone wants a graduate with experience, right? So at the same time, everyone wants a business with a track record. So, you know, there's a bit of creative license that we kind of used in the early days to kind of influence and attract new customers. The build process was really challenging for us, A, because we bootstrapped it, so we're trying to run it on a budget, and secondly, because we wanted, you know, I guess the best outcome of all of that to take to a customer and say, we have everything that you need. The reality of it, mate, was in our first instances of selling to customers, we didn't even have a product. So putting the cart before the horse literally was the most important thing for us at that time, because if we wasted our time building the perfect product and then taking it to market, we never would have launched.
So when you're pitching to potential customers, you pretty much had vaporware. It was, you know, it didn't exist.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, we always paint a vision, right? And even when we sell today, we're always painting a vision and understanding what customer needs are and building to that effect. But in the early days, you know, you've really got to lead with a concept. So what we did have was a beautifully designed website on WordPress, which I created in my spare time using Photoshop and the like. And then we had business cards printed at Officeworks, and, you know, we had sick leave or, you know, annual leave we could take when we needed to, from our day jobs to actually represent the company, right, that we were building. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was basically showing concepts, presentations we'd come up with, and then as we started to get more of a product actually built, showing clickable prototypes and kind of showing our customers what we could do. And then once we gained commitment from our early customers, we went in ahead and built exactly what they needed, and pivoted from there. And that's kind of been the ongoing trend for our business since.
Who was the very first customer?
Our very first customer, I'm proud to say, is a business by the name of The Minimalist. So theminimalist.com.au, which is a homewares and kind of, you know, gifting online store. So they had a physical store in Albion Street in Sydney, Surrey Hills. And Leah is the founder and owner of that business. The serendipitous story behind that is we had bought a new side table for our house, and the delivery experience was pretty average. I emailed Leah directly myself and said, I'm going to come out and show you what we can do. And famously, she was our very first customer. We built an extension into her shopping cart technology and went live, and she's still with us till this day. So you know, that's been a really, really cool journey for us with her.
So that was a pretty much a cold email.
Absolutely. Yeah. So basically getting a reason to send an email to somebody, right? So if I hadn't purchased from her, she probably wouldn't have read my email. But because I you know, then there's some genuine care and concern in that relationship being built. And in fact, that's how we earned our first three customers, was basically on the receiving end of a delivery experience. We went back and said, this is how I as a customer could probably make it better for other customers in future.
Right. Okay. Your customer base now, are you generally finding it's more, are you still doing that outreach, or are you now got a mix of people that are going, you know, are identifying that shipping process is an issue for their business and they're coming to you?
Well, I think we were quite fortunate, you know, riding the tailwinds of e-commerce growth. I think the projected CAGR of e-commerce back when we started the business was, you know, circa 10 to 12% over the next 5 years, right? So over the last 5 years, looking back, it's actually been closer to 20% or 15 right. to 20%. So it actually exceeded analyst predictions. So in the early days, it was very much an outbound outreach strategy. So, you know, it started with Will and I literally going out to try and find more customers like the ones that we were able to successfully get on, because you want to try and replicate that success. So homewares, gifting, that was the space we focused on. So we went to a few gift fairs and tried to sell to exhibitors who, funnily enough, don't want anybody to sell to them because they're there to sell. So anyway, figured out a few different techniques and strategies to speak to these types of people. And then very quickly, I think probably about 12 months or so in, we got a bit of positive PR in kind of the mainstream press, and then the inbound started hitting our team. Right. And around about May 2016, the funnel completely inverted and it was complete inbound lead management. So we had, you know, a lot of our loyal customers kind of thankfully advocating the brand and kind of recommending us to their friends. They would then come through and then they'd recommend more friends, and then the press releases that we would do would then generate more demand for our business. And we had to figure out what our inbound lead conversion strategy was and how best to consult to our customers, right? Because we just had to deal with that level of demand without dropping the ball.
Yeah. So, and well, I mean, the next question then is, so how did you do that? If you've all of a sudden you've got this, you know, giant pipeline of people, you know, emailing you and calling you and things like that, what was the, how did you prioritize those?
The first thing was, you know, and we still try our very best to kind of maintain this today, is really the speed of return contact. So when somebody's inquiring on your website or they've created an account on your website, you really want to try and speak to them at that very moment, which is really tough for businesses to do, particularly as it scales and you get a lot of inbound interest, right? So then looking at how we automate that process in a way that delivers all the relevant information to the prospect at the particular time of their inquiry, and then as they're starting to navigate through your product. So that's the journey we're on now. But previously, right, it was just throwing bodies at it, right? It's like, okay, we need more sales team members to actually support new customers coming through the front door. And we need to actually give more support through the onboarding experience as well. So we've kind of over-resourced in those areas. But when you start to resource those areas and you get more demand, you've then got to resource again. So it's this constant chicken and egg balance. And we do, unfortunately, drop a few eggs here and there, which creates a negative customer experience. But on the whole, you know, creating a positive experience is everything the guys are driving toward at the moment.
It's funny because we have a software, cloud-based software client. And one of the things we're working on at the moment is automating that onboarding process. And the danger that we see is that if it's too automated, they feel that there's no human. People still like that human contact when they're onboarding, even if it is a cloud-based piece of software. Do you find that as well?
Yeah, I think nothing beats a personal touch, you know, in that respect. But, you know, it's a real dichotomy, right, Simon? So I think the theory says if your product requires significant process change, then a phone call, an in-depth consultation is critical for the success of that customer with your product, right? So if I'm getting you to completely rip out everything you do today in terms of how you fulfill orders to customers, which is a very delicate and precious moment for you as a business owner, because it's all about reliability. If I really screw that up for you, you will never come back and you will never stay with us. If I get it right and I continue to get it right, then you will stay with us for the lifetime of your business.
Right.
So, you know, it is a delicate balance. You don't want to over rely on technology to do the onboarding for you. But then you look at some products like Zendesk, for example, or you know, even products like Intercom, which you know, is a product I'm obsessed with. You know, there really isn't anyone that you can call to kind of speak to about how you use those products. You kind of learn. So I think it is a delicate balance because those businesses prove that you don't necessarily need a phone call. But in the earlier days of your business, I think phone calls to customers and even having, you know, long-winded demonstrations and consultation with customers is so critical because you're learning what your customers' challenges are from their very words, right? Mm. And then once you actually get enough data together, you can then see what the common trends and patterns are to then formulate the right strategies in self-service as well. Because there is a group of people, particularly as we market to small businesses, that actually don't want to speak to anybody.
Yeah.
They want to do things on their own. Yeah. There's a big DIY crowd that actually just want to be enabled to get going on their own.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you've really got to have that dual focus when it comes to onboarding.
I think that's really key for me because a piece of software that I've been using about 6 months now, 6-7 months, Lawpath. I don't know if you've ever used them or heard of them, but they're basically
heard of them.
Yeah, yeah, it's basically legal agreements or templated legal agreements. So if you need a
terrific,
you know, a staff contract or whatever, you just go in there and pull one out and rewrite it a little bit and adjust it and so on and so forth. When we signed up for the trial version of that, we were just getting bombarded with phone calls and emails and, you know, their sales team trying to upsell us. And we're like, you know what, all we wanted was one contract here. You know, and it just seemed hideously hideously over the top.
Pushy in terms of
us wasn't an essential service. You know, us legal agreements were, look, we need them, but we don't necessarily need them right now. Our business isn't going to fall apart if we don't have them. You know, it's a nice to have. And interestingly, of all the emails, the sales emails that we got and all the phone calls that we got, the thing that actually tipped us over the edge to pay for an annual subscription was an email that said, for the next 48 hours, you can have an annual subscription for 50%. And we went, oh, $200. Yep, do it. You know, that was that was all that it took. Clever. But the other interesting point that you made there was Zendesk and Intercom. And Intercom's a product that Matt, my business partner, is, you know, froths at the mouth at. He loves it. And Zendesk, not quite as much. But the interesting thing, I think, with both of those versus your product is, again, Intercom and Zendesk aren't what I would describe as, you know, business critical systems. They're, again, they're nice to have. Or you know, a business could kind of survive without them, whereas you are an essential service. And maybe that's why there's more of a need for not necessarily a face-to-face conversation, but at least a human contact.
Yeah, we talk a lot about core versus non-core activities, right? And so is it a process which is a profit driver for your business? It's funny because shipping sometimes fits in the same camp as customer service. Yeah. Yep, you can offshore it or you can outsource it to a third-party logistics provider. But the predominant view in an Amazon, you know, era is really about ownership of that logistics stack. So more and more, fulfillment is being seen as a core process to a business. So that criticality kind of plays into it. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's, you know, I could do my finances, you know, in Excel, but it's better to do it in Xero.
Yeah.
You know, I could do customer service in an email inbox, but it's better to do it in Zendesk. Shipping kind of, toes the line a little bit, you know, teeters over the edge, because you could do your shipping manually by hand. You just got to throw a hell of a lot more people at it.
Yeah.
And the reality is, if you're scaling like crazy, you need a solution that scales with the business and doesn't add operational overheads, right?
Yeah.
So that's where we come in. And so I think your point with Lawpath was also about really understanding the intent of your prospect. So the person inquiring, you know, or where do they fit within the business? You know, are they the decision maker? Are they an influencer? How big is that business? How do you profile that business well enough to understand what sales approach you need to take? Identifying for us, if you've got an entrepreneur who puts an inquiry in, you know, after 5 p.m., we know that they're probably more likely to do their own thing. So email is probably a more accurate strategy for that prospect. However, if it's a fairly large business and there's somebody who is a key decision maker, they want information right there and then. So you make as many phone calls as you can to get in touch with that person because they're craving information. So that, you know, you've really got to understand your audience well enough to then tailor your approach. And that's something that we've evolved into over time. You know, sometimes we get some very honest feedback from customers like you would have with Lawpath, right? Somewhere it's like, shit, guys, just leave me alone. You know, don't make me regret the fact that I clicked the button, you know, and I think that's really important to understand.
What have been the best ad channels for you? Because in terms of reaching the your end users or your customers, because I think I've possibly heard you on some podcasts, and I'm kind of thinking one of them was I can't remember the name of the podcast. It was an investment finance podcast.
Yeah. Look,
you tell me, and I'll have a think about that whilst I.
No, that's okay. In terms of ad channels, right? So, when you're a new business, you really need to establish some form of credibility in the market. So really talking about your wins is a critical component to an early stage business. And I remember in the early days, you know, kind of founders of businesses that I really looked up to who were early in their stage said to me, it's funny, nobody wanted to write about our business until I wrote about our business and sent it to them. And right. So, you know, you take that in your stride and you think, well, I could sit here and I could try and, you know, kind of show myself up as a growth hacker, which is a dirty word these days, or a growth marketer, and try and find these tactical ways to drive a million signups in 24 hours and really hack the system. But the reality is the most effective channel for any new business is PR. And targeted PR. Okay. So understanding what channels you're going after and understanding, you know, where your customer is and who you're actually reaching with that communication. So I think for us early on was harnessing the power of PR, and we kind of stumbled across it because we were doing a pitch at, I think it was Innovation Bay. So basically pitching everywhere we went, every chance we got, even if we didn't have a product we were pitching. And by pitching everywhere we went, you actually don't know who's going to be in the room.
Yeah.
And on one of those occasions, there was a journo from the SMH who heard us talk and said, wow, this whole delivery thing is going to be a really big issue for e-commerce. I want to talk to you about it. So we did an article with him, and a month later it went to press, and then that created our first big inbound push from people wanting to learn more. And then once we kind of got a taste of that, we said, right, how do we do more of that? So then we actually targeted startup press because we knew that that was important to establish some credibility with the investment community and some early startup businesses. And then we pushed into mainstream press. And we couldn't do that, unfortunately, through the front door. We had to go through a PR agency to do that, which is a significant cost for a new business.
Yeah.
But that was a very effective strategy in our first year or two of operation, and something that, you know, is now easier to come by in terms of you know, talkability. But understanding your channels, your market, what messages you need to push out, I think is critical for any founder or marketer to really embrace.
How did you keep that PR agency honest? Because I've worked with PR agencies. I've had you know, business partners involved in PR, and you know, one of the things I see a lot of in PR is that they take your money and then they tell you they're going to go and do lots of work and pitch lots of things. And at the end of the month, there's nothing, you know, and a lot of people then don't understand that. And I'm kind of guessing you've had that same experience. So how do you keep them honest, or is that just part of the gamble with PR?
I think, you know, partnerships are so incredibly important early on. You can't do everything yourself. You're not a specialist. You know, the fact that you're getting into a new business or you're trying to grow a business means that is your primary focus, right? So the fundamentals of your customer's experience is a critical channel for you to influence. What you can't do necessarily well is go and speak to press, right? So you need someone to help you with that. Now, oftentimes, small business owners think that they don't have a hell of a lot of choice, and a lot of larger firms that are servicing those businesses don't tend to value them as a business, right? So for us, we ran our selection process like any large business would. We put out a request for tender to the market. We said, right, you're the three agencies we're comparing. We want you to pitch back to us based on our needs, and we're going to evaluate you using all this criteria. So we did that, and then we actually found that one of the three agencies we evaluated gave a real shit about our business because they actually thought about the future of our company and where they could help us take it. They didn't just give us a generic credentials pack and say, here are all of our credentials. If you want to be with us, here's our retainer. We negotiated hard on price. And then as a counterpart to that negotiation, what we said was, we want a weekly work plan and we want a weekly check-in call and we want to make sure we're tracking activity, not just outcome.
Right.
And it's kind of similar to your question on sales process, right? So if the dollars aren't coming in, the first thing you've got to do is look at your activity. So are the team making enough phone calls? Are they having enough demonstrations? In the same view, if you're not getting enough articles published, are your PR representatives having enough conversations with journalists, and are they writing enough content for you to then get you to that outcome? And, you know, a lot of PR agencies probably hate me saying this, but, you know, that's the way that I would definitely recommend anyone working with any retainer-based business as a service provider to them operates. What is the activity you are doing for my business this week? And if it's not good enough, you terminate a contract.
Just out of interest, and you know, how much were you spending in that? Those sort of, you know, for the PR guys, what was the sort of budget you're allocating to them for? And you don't have to answer that. So, but it's just, I'm just kind of interested from an early stage, you know, business like that. Where you were, you know, how much budget you were putting into that.
I'll give you a range only because I can't remember the specific number, but okay. I know it was somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 a month, right?
Okay.
Which is a significant amount to spend as a small business.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, the business that we received on the back of that was, you know, definitely worthwhile.
Right.
And if you think about it as a full-time employee to a business at that scale,
yeah,
then you need to work them like a full-time employee.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't let them just get away with, look, this is the way the industry works, darling. This is why you've got me on board. You should be saying, well, this is what I expect and this is what I need.
Yeah.
But you also need to be open to pivot and open to feedback, because they are the experts in their craft and they will recommend what's going to get you a better hit rate. So you've got to be flexible.
Did you look at any other channels? Were you using
Yep.
You know, things like AdWords or Facebook advertising, or, you know, organic
Yep.
search, that sort of thing?
Yep, we were using so SEO is a little bit of a longer term strategy for us, which in your early days you don't have the luxury of spending a hell of a lot of time and money in.
Yeah.
So critically, paid channels become very important. We experimented a lot. We lost a lot of money on things. You know, we kind of made some early wins, etc. So AdWords was a key part of our strategy, and it always boggles my mind about how much money Google makes out of AdWords, you know, for a small business like us to spend what we spent, and thinking about all the others out there. But AdWords is a critical channel. If you're not discoverable, you don't exist. And secondly, we did dabble with social, but social is a real tricky one. It's an easy way to lose a lot of money, particularly because costs of acquisition on those channels is really tricky. So content marketing was kind of the first foray for us, and then promoting content. But we found that a more intimate setting for us was selling through expos and events and partnerships, and that indirect channel was a really important channel for us to win new business. So we kind of, we had a three-pronged strategy, right? So we were always on with kind of AdWords for searchability and PR, because that aids searchability and also improves your SEO like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the second channel was referral through indirect channels. So consultants that would recommend shipping products, really understanding what their customers needed and making sure that we did what they needed, not just giving them a referral clip. We don't believe in paying commissions. We believe in delivering the best solution for our partners. But then the third part, which I think a lot of people overlook, is really the customer experience you're giving to your existing customers. I can't remember the stats, but off the top of my head, I think it is, you know, 7 times cheaper to basically get a customer to repeat purchase than it is to get a new customer to buy.
Yeah,
right?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And so it's so critical that you keep your customers loyal, but then also that they refer new business onto you. And that can't be done through giving them just an incentive. Hey, I'll give you $100 if you just bring me another business. So that whole like Uber referral model works for some businesses, but not all. What works 9 times out of 10 is over-servicing and giving the best customer experience to your customer. In our early days, that was all we did. And, you know, we made some questionable decisions, right? So even for one of our customers where we delivered an item to one of their customers and it didn't arrive on time, the margin we would have made on that delivery was under $1. But we sent them a $50 pack of cupcakes to make up for the misery of that problem in our very early stage. Right. That does not scale, but what does scale is the impression that you're giving to customers at that time.
Yeah.
So anyway, long story short, and I can talk about it forever, customer experience and being obsessed with that is really important. Yeah. As you scale, it gets harder to do that. Right now, I'm trying to drive by wire, you know, that, you know, you're trying to get feedback through data rather than feedback through voice, speaking to a customer. So making sure your organization is charged up behind customer experience is really critical. And right now, NPS is our central focus at Shipit.
There's a dozen more questions I have for you, and I'm just going to try and be selective just based on the time we've got. But one thing I do want to touch on, you mentioned earlier on about software. What are some of the software that you guys use internally? Some things from a marketing perspective that you mentioned Zendesk, you mentioned Intercom. Is there anything else that you guys are sort of, that's our go-to piece of software for doing that?
Yeah, so I mean, early doors, we were using MailChimp for email automation. But as we kind of scaled, it wasn't giving us all the metrics that we needed right the way through the funnel. And you couldn't, well, to my knowledge, you know, it wasn't the best tool for lead nurturing, et cetera. So we used a whole suite of things. I think Wishpond was in there, Unbounce, you know, kind of all these other products, AdRoll, you know, But what we actually found worked quite well was looking at an all-in-one solution. So we had our sales CRM sitting in a different product and our marketing automation sitting in a different product. And it disconnected that journey for A, the customer, and B, for our sales and marketing team. So we implemented Zoho pretty recently, and you know, the jury's still out as to whether or not it's the best solution for us, but bang for buck and feature-wise, that's something that we kind of went down the path on for marketing automation and CRM. And it's eventually found its way into project management, and it's found its way into digital signature, and it's finding its way into calendar management. So it's one of those products which starts to take on more. The other piece of software which we use quite religiously is obviously Xero, and that's been quite critical for us from the get-go. And then racking my brain, but obviously the Atlassian suite is kind of indispensable for us. So Confluence for knowledge sharing and Jira for issue tracking and kind of feature development have been quite critical for us.
Are you a Slack office? Are you all on Slack?
Oh yeah, that's the one that I forgot about. There you go. So we've been on Slack since day one, and it's amazing how much money they can make from you as you grow. It costs you nothing for ages, which is the same as Zendesk, and then all of a sudden you are paying thousands for chat. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, that's us, and we've integrated bloody everything into Slack. So it's really handy though. One of the ones, Simon, sorry, I'll just throw it out there. A little nifty app called Hey Taco is a great integration for Slack. Not sure if you've heard of it. Think of tacos like frequent flyer points for your staff. So if somebody does something good, you basically throw a taco emoji into the Slack channel and you tag their name and they get a taco. And every 50 tacos, our team members can redeem a gift voucher, a movie voucher, or a day off. You know, it's kind of one of those little
things that gets away from it. That's pretty cool. How many staff have you got now?
We're at 60 at the moment.
Cool.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of tacos going out there every week, it sounds like.
I could sit with you on another podcast about the taco economy and the need for inflation. You know,
is there sort of dirty backstreet taco exchanges where you can get things?
Yeah, you see it, mate. There's a lot of taco trading that goes on. Days off these days are really cheap, so we've got to up the prices, I think, of these rewards.
How many for a day off? What do you
trade for? I think you only need 100 tacos, mate, and you can give 5 a day. So, you know, it's pretty easy to get a day off these days if you know the right people.
The other thing I really want to touch on quickly before we sort of wind up is your previous experience with some of the big brands. Was Unilever, was it P&G as well?
P&G. So
what was your favorite brand in all of that you've worked with?
Oh, it's like choosing your favorite child, Simon. Come on.
We all know we have a favorite child, mate. Let's not try and deny that.
It's really tricky. There are two which stand out, and I'm going to pick one from each business to be fair. So my favorite from P&G was Gillette, only because of their obsession with the customer. Now, it's probably a dirty word to say that now in marketing land.
We'll talk about Gillette in a second. But
the sheer fact that they could you know, what they were delivering to customers in Southeast Asia, at least for me, was confidence and the ability to get jobs and to basically live the life that you want to live. So that was one of the products that I was really obsessed about when I was living and working in Asia. And then the product in Australia that I loved was Rexona. Rexona is one of those little battler brands they're quite a large brand, but it's kind of been in everyone's cupboard from day dot. And just how that brand is evolving and what it does to actually, you know, really, you know, drive benefit to customer, that's something that really, really sits with me. So that were kind of the two brands.
You're going to have to give me your 2 cents about Gillette, because we actually I think you're going out. This will be episode 54 when we finally get it out. But episode 50, we had a conversation about Gillette. Give me your 2 cents about the recent ad.
You know, it's quite interesting, right? So I'm going to dance around this.
There's a deep breath of avoidance there. I heard that.
No, look, it's really interesting to see how the internet you know, really influences what brands do and vice versa, right? So, look, I've read the literature, you know, kind of Mark Ritson's very clear view on it, you know, some of which I tend to agree with, but a lot of it that I don't. I think that it's really great and bold for a brand to really embrace this. So if you think about, you know, a lot of overtly masculine brands, it's hard for them to come back. Lynx had this problem when I was working at Unilever, where it wasn't about female empowerment. And, you know, people wised up to the fact that, well, the same company who owns Lynx also owns Dove, which is all about female empowerment, right? So you've got this dichotomy where you need greater transparency. And I think Procter & Gamble, you know, their primary customer is female, and they've got this male, overtly male brand that they need to come to terms with. Yeah. So I think it was a natural evolution for the brand, you know, but on the contrary, I think that it was too... You know, it was too focused on trying to be topical to create conversation, which they succeeded in, but it kind of backfired in a way for them as a brand. You know, I think, you know, addressing the Me Too movement head on versus talking about the problems around overt masculinism and what it does to kind of the whole, you know, society in general, yeah. I think, you know, they probably went too far in one direction where they probably didn't need to as a brand. It's content marketing kind of, you know, that's gone beyond. You need to live a brand purpose. And I think the brand purpose really links back to a product. And at the end of the day, if you forget about your product and your customer, then you've done something wrong. And that says something about Gillette today, who is still trying to sell razors with $50 cartridges, right, that yeah. people don't yeah. use anymore. Yeah. So the brand has other fundamentals to focus on, in my view.
And it's interesting when we spoke about it that Patrick Condren, who was on the episode then, who's a news reporter for Channel 7, he made the point that says, you know, do men or, you know, boys need to hear this message? Yes, they do. Do they need Absolutely. To hear it from a razor blade company? Probably not. No.
Probably not. No. Exactly. So that's kind of the view.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think my point as well to add on to that was that the tragedy of this situation is that you cannot be on, certainly on the internet, certainly on Twitter, you are either on one side or the other side of the conversation. You cannot be in this gray area where you go, look, you know what, I don't appreciate that advert, but let's have a discussion about it. And because as soon as you say that you didn't agree with the advert, you are then classed as a, you know, misogynist, you know, wife beater. So that's funny, where I find it? That's just yeah. that kind of there's no opportunity for discussion when brands do these things. You're in one camp or the other.
And I think that's a real concern for freedom of speech and for you know, transparency, because businesses and individuals are going to toe one line or the other, because that extremist, you know, kind of everyone is waiting on Twitter with pitchforks, right, ready to roast whatever opinion sticks its head out of the sand. So I think what's really concerning to me is that people are really filtering what they say and what they do. And famously, you know, you look at sort of Trump winning the election in 2016, not a lot of people said that they would vote for him, but people did, because they didn't want to be heard to have voted for him, but they actually really wanted him in. Yeah. So this transparency fading is a real concern that I think everybody should be worried about.
Yeah. I mean, I made a comment the other week two, 3 days ago on Twitter about philanthropy. And I was like, you know, if rich billionaires want to spend their money on, you know, curing diseases and helping kids build schools or building schools for kids, then, you know, that let's go ahead and let them do it. And honestly, the pitchforks came straight out, because you know, people were saying, well, philanthropy is an indication that society isn't taxing people properly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, you know, honestly, it came from every angle. And I'm like, whoa, you know? And I've done that before as well. I think it was about a year ago when I made a comment about how I thought internships were a great opportunity for you know, older teenage kids and kids at university. And then there was the pitchforks came out about how you shouldn't ask people to work for free. And I was like, well, anyway.
Yeah, anyway, I mean, the world really is turning into a YouTube comments section, mate. That's kind of what it is. It's really the dredge just floats to the surface at the moment, and it's amazing. Yeah. Anyway,
so last three questions for you. Look, we've talked about some of your favorite software and other brands that you've worked with, but I normally ask people about their favorite brands, but with you, I'm going to say you must see a lot of, well, you do see a lot of e-commerce online retailers. Who's your favorite out there? Which sort of website should we go and look at, or the products that we should go and look at that you think is a really, you know, good and beautiful experience? Sorry to put you on the spot with that one as well.
No. I'm trying not to give the obvious, right? So this morning I was sitting in a cafe thinking, Jesus, I'm a wanker. I've got AirPods, an Apple Watch, an iPad Pro, a MacBook. You know, God, I'm using my Apple Pencil. I've got dongles out of my, you know, my ass here. It's so ignoring Apple completely for a minute, because I think they just continue to dominate in brand experience, which I absolutely am passionate about. I think if I look at kind of retailers that have really got it together, you know, Zara is an amazing brand. So forget, you know, I've got pitchforks already around, but you know, if you think about Zara as a brand, yeah, what it actually does for the end consumer is amazing. You know, and in terms of what they're embracing now with ship from store fulfillment in our kind of space is pretty incredible. You can place an order at 11 o'clock at night and have it on your desk or at your front door by 8 a.m. the next day, right? So that for me is a really tremendous experience. Sephora, who's one of our clients, is really phenomenal. A lot of people say retail's dead. Just jump down to kind of your main Sephora store on a weekend and it is absolutely pumping. Customers everywhere. The experience and really nailing what it is that their demographic want is incredible. So those would be kind of the two core brands for me that I really look up to.
What about some of the smaller ones, some little independent ones that you've seen that you like their products, even if it's the sort of e-commerce experiences, you know, still not quite there.
Do you know what? There's a little known brand called The Wine Gallery. I don't know if you're familiar with that. So Tom Mellencamp is the founder of that business, was an early customer of ours, and that's how I discovered it. Just the amount of curation and detail that goes into it. So effectively, their mission is to basically deliver the sommelier experience to anyone at home, right, by understanding what it is that you like. So they're designing to your palate. And one of the things I ordered through the Christmas break was a wine advent calendar.
Wife got one of those as well.
Incredible. Yeah. Incredible. And it, you know, just the packaging, the curation, the selection, each thing had a card which showed a recipe of what you could pair that wine with, you know, the story of the origin of the wine and everything else. I think in a nutshell, that was one of the most impressive experiences I've had from a small brand, and something that you're seeing more of with more brands giving a shit about the customer experience.
Good example, that one. Second to last question, what's on the horizon for you guys in 2019? What sort of, is there anything big that you've got planned, or new features, or anything that you can tell us about?
To be honest with you, 2019 will make or break this business, Simon. So I think one of the things that we've really come to terms with is Will and I are never happy with status quo, and you know, we believe we're not moving fast enough. Right. So a couple of things that we've got on the horizon is you know, a new product. So our returns product, which we kind of soft launched last year, is coming up for full release in the next couple of months. So that'd be quite big for our customers and hopefully the market. So we want to really improve return experiences for end customers. The second big thing is what we're seeing a real trend in is democratizing logistics. So there are a few brands starting to do it well, but really giving smaller courier companies a chance to go after the retail market. So our platform is an open marketplace. You know, we allow any carrier to kind of, you know, sell to our customer base, and we're doing that because it provides the best customer experience. So I can't give too much away on that front, but that's something that we're totally looking at, and you'll see a lot more carriers on our platform delivering a much better experience. One of the new ones actually is Drive Yellow. They're an on-demand delivery experience akin to Uber. They power BWS, which is Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Woolworths kind of on-demand delivery, and that's something now that everybody can take advantage of on our platform. So seeing hyper-local fast delivery is one of those areas that you'll see growing within our business over the next 12 months. And just to add to it all, international expansion as well. So we soft launched into Asia at the end of last year, and we have a few customers over there. So now it's really about tightening that up and going to market in a big way.
Final question, if anybody wants to get hold of you, ask you a question, or they're interested in your services, what's the best way of getting hold of you?
LinkedIn. So LinkedIn, if you look me up, Rob Zada is kind of my handle. So linkedin.com/Rob Zada is one word, or just look me up, Rob Hango Zada. SEO is great. You'll find me, add me. Or alternatively, you can drop me an email, rob@shipit.com, and I'll get back to you.
Awesome. Mate, thank you very much for your time today. It's been very enlightening, some really good discussions there. And let's hope no pitchforks come out about our comments about Gillette, but no doubt they will. Anyway.
No, it is absolute what it is. Pleasure, Simon.
No worries. Good luck for 2019.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
That is it for episode number 53. Thank you very much for joining me. It has been a pleasure as always. Hopefully we will see you back for episode number 54. Last thing, please remember, rate and review us on iTunes. Otherwise, we'll see you soon. Thank you.